Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. A new investigation finds Native Americans are less likely than other groups to gain access to the National Organ Donor List for life-saving liver transplants. Among contributing factors listed in the investigation published in the Washington Post include lack of resources and late detection of diseases that affect the liver. We'll talk with health experts about the disparity for Native Americans and liver transplants right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In California, Ohlone people and Berkeley City officials are celebrating the land back of a sacred site. Christina Onnestad reports.
It's considered the largest land back of an urban city. The two-acre West Berkeley Shell Mound is where the Ohlone people first established a human settlement on the shores of the San Francisco Bay 5,700 years ago. Fast forward to today. Through hundreds of years of colonization, stolen lands, and a mission system that enslaved the First Nations people, the site is now a paved-over parking lot. But that's about to change. Berkeley Mayor Jesse Aragin.
Berkeley made history, and we did it by honoring the first people who live on this land. And this historic step is critical to righting past wrongs.
The city of Berkeley committed $1.5 million to help purchase the land for the Segorite Land Trust and Ohlone Confederated Villages of Lujan with a new vision for indigenous cultural revitalization. Melissa Nelson is chair of the board of directors of the Segorite Land Trust. They raised $25 million to purchase the land.
A place for gathering, for ceremony. We want to restore the native landscape, daylight the creek that flows through this area. We want to plant native medicines, native foods, so that we can again gather and tend to our traditional relatives.
The trust plans to build a commemorative park with a new shell mound and a cultural center to house cultural objects. I'm Christina Onnestad.
More than 1,700 athletes competed in the Arctic Winter Games are now headed home. After a week of competition in South Central Alaska, they hailed from six Arctic nations. They all competed for ulus, medals shaped like a curved knife. Alaska took home the most, 221, including 70 gold. KMBA's Rhonda McBride has more.
Some call the Arctic Winter Games the Olympics of the North. But the Dene Games and indigenous Arctic sports are what make this a one-of-a-kind event. Marjorie Tawbone has been involved in the Dene Games for 20 years, and now she's a coach.
Just being able to come together with international friends and cousins, it warms my heart.
It's very emotional.
Judah Eason from Kenai won a bronze ulu in the finger pull, which puts hand strength to a test. But he was more excited when elders awarded him a medal for fair play.
That's the heart of these games, more than anything else. The ability to mentor others and win and lose graciously and build each other up as a community.
Are you going to watch the hockey game?
Yeah. Yes, that's what we're here for.
Then you probably want to head for the back corner where the elevator is.
Okay. Yeah.
Jack Tim and his wife, Kathy, are among 2,000 volunteers. The Wasilla couple says with so many people involved, they're surprised at how this mega event has run like a well-oiled machine.
There's so much positivity just flowing through this building.
Win or lose, it was a chance for teams to play their very best, like Team Nunavut from the far eastern Canadian Arctic. Although they were disappointed to be knocked out of the semifinals and had to settle for a bronze ulu, Luke Joy said it was far from a total loss.
We all came together as a team and started communicating together, and we just found our inner peace.
Planning is already underway for the next Arctic Winter Games to be held in Whitehorse in 2026. Reporting from Wasilla, Alaska, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IACB, who support this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. For Native Americans, a liver transplant may be farther out of reach compared to other populations. An analysis by reporters from the Washington Post and The Markup, a nonprofit media company, finds Native Americans make the organ donor wait list at less than a third the rate of their white counterparts. That's despite numerous studies over the years showing Native Americans have the highest mortality rates from liver disease. The analysis points to several factors for the discrepancy, including late diagnosis of liver disease and lack of resources to navigate the long and complicated liver transplant process. In this hour, we'll talk with medical experts, including doctors who do liver transplant surgery, about the disparities natives face in accessing liver transplant and what's being done to close that gap. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. We're also at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And remember, if you have any questions about your specific medical situation, it's always best to consult with your own physician or healthcare provider. Joining us now from Phoenix, Arizona, is Dr. Loretta Christensen. She's the Chief Medical Officer for the Indian Health Service. She is Navajo. Hello, Dr. C, and welcome back to NAC.
Hi, Sean. Glad to be with you. Thank you for this time.
You bet. In Portland, Oregon, we're joined by Dr. Erin Maynard. She's the Division Head of Abdominal Organ Transplant at Oregon Health and Science University and the Surgical Director of the Liver Transplant Program at the Portland VA. Good morning, Erin, and welcome to our show.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me and talking about such an important topic.
Absolutely. And joining us also from Phoenix, Arizona, is Selena Thomas. She's a patient navigator for the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, and she is Diné. Hello, Selena. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, everyone. Yate. Thank you for having me here.
Yate, Selena. Let's start now with Dr. C and the Indian Health Service. What happens, Dr. C, at Indian Health Service at IHS when someone comes in with serious liver disease that might require a transplant? What's the process?
Okay, well, thanks for the question, Sean. It is, we are primarily a primary care service across the Indian Health Service. So all of our providers are very tuned in to how to take patients on a path to get to where they need to go. So if we diagnose the liver disease, we already have relationships with our regional transplant centers so that we know their protocols, they know us, and when we make a referral to these transplant centers that we can stay on the same page and follow the pathway that they have set up to be effective at the transplant. So we would examine, do the labs, have a conversation with our patients saying, you know, your liver is failing, you're likely going to need a transplant or a new liver. Explain that process to them, do all the scoring, the background, all the necessary criteria to qualify for a liver transplant, and then speak to that transplant center and then make an arrangement to take our patient there. We use what we call purchase referred care, which is a fund that pays for any care that we cannot provide at one of our facilities or one of our healthcare hospitals. And we use that funding to support that patient. You know, I know we have a subject matter expert on that will say a lot about that criteria, so I'll leave that to her. But we have to make sure they're in a good position to qualify for a transplant and then talk to them about things that we call our social determinants of health. Do you have transportation? Of course, do you understand what this will entail? This will be a big surgery. It'll be a recovery, and you're going to have to take care of yourself well, take your medicines. And really, it's a big commitment that they have to make to be able to qualify and go through with the procedure. And then, of course, we like to tell the family what's going on, because the family will be the support system, especially in Indian country. They'll step up. They'll make sure that they get everything they need and take care of them after the procedure is done. So it's a really large spectrum. And then, of course, they come back to our reservation areas where they're from, and our doctors will see them again and keep track of them very closely and with touching base with the regional system as often as possible. So that's the kind of a outline of what we do for the patients that come in with significant liver disease.
All right. And Dr. C, is there a general timeline you can share with regard to how long it might take a typical patient from the time they first come in and are diagnosed to the point where they're able to be referred and then ultimately get that much needed transplant?
Well, you know, it is so very important to pick this up right away. And this is obviously one of the things that is a challenge, is that we unfortunately get people very late in the liver disease process. So sometimes we're moving very, very fast. If they're really close, you know, to end stage and they make the criteria, we move them through, you know, in less like 2 to 4 weeks. We make the referrals right away. We do all the prep work and labs and things that are necessary. If someone comes in, hopefully at an earlier stage where we can counsel, speak to them, then that process will be longer, because they may not make the list right away, but they have to be on our radar to make sure that we're tracking them very, very carefully. So it will vary for the time period, depending on the status that they have when they present to our providers.
All right. Now, we mentioned that analysis by the markup in the Washington Post when we started the show, and it found that natives don't make it as often on the liver transplant list like people of other backgrounds do. And it mentioned funding and the Indian Health Service's ability to pay for liver transplant services. Now, you just mentioned the purchase referral care that's provided that provides that funding. Do you know if that's something that's known inside Indian Health Service? Is there adequate funding to provide all these transplants, or is there a disparity there with regard to just the availability of funds?
We can absolutely support paying for all of the organ transplants that a patient might need. The fund is available if they qualify, which is, you know, pretty straightforward. They have to be an enrolled member. They have to be from the area in which they're being seen. That region, they have to live within that region. Just certain qualifiers like that. That's easy. We just go through that list. But, you know, we're widely able to support any organ transplant for one of our American Indian and Alaska Native people. I do feel, though, that the public isn't as knowledgeable. Our communities don't know this. And this is one of the things we have to improve, that we want to expand, and we really want to get out there and explain not only the symptoms that your liver might not be working, because that's key to get them to start coming in for care, but to them to understand that we will support them through every step of this, that we are there, we have the funding, we have the knowledge, and we want to get them where they need to get. So it is going to be a big campaign of information, community-level education, culturally sensitive information that is understandable and makes sense to the people we serve. But yes, I'm just going to say yes, we absolutely will support organ transplant.
All right. And liver transplants, with regard to other types of organ transplants that IHS provides funding for instance, kidney transplants, about what percentage of those transplants are liver transplants?
A very small, very, very small percentage. We do a significant amount of kidney transplants. It's a very facile process that, again, you deliver it over time, you educate your patients, and when they need it, we're ready to go. I will also say, though, our improvement in treatment of diabetes and other diseases has decreased our need for transplant quite a bit, which tells you if you really focus on the etiology or the causes of the liver disease, I hope to have the same outcomes dealing with the need for liver transplant. But it's only 0.8 of all people that are transplanted are American Indian and Alaska Native. And you can imagine that if you spread that over the 37 states that we cover in the probably 2.8 million, it's a very small amount of our transplant patients.
And Dr. C, so it sounds like IHS has a lot of capacity here and a lot of resources, but is there still a need for more awareness about liver disease amongst Native people in our communities?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything we do is and should be patient-centered, which means we have to educate our patients on how to be well, how to take care of themselves, that they need to come in for routine care so that we can pick up on things very early. We need to explain what symptoms. People don't realize what's happening to them is liver disease at times. So when they come, unfortunately, they're very, very ill. And it's very, very late, and some and many will not qualify for transplant, unfortunately. So it's up to us to keep increasing our patient education, our community public messaging, which we're really enhancing right now at headquarters, to make sure everybody understands this is what you look for. If you have this, please come in right away. Please get your regular physicals every year. Do your screenings for cancer and for other diseases. And this is all incumbent upon us to continuously improve the information that we share with the people we serve.
Well, Dr. C, thank you for kicking off our conversation here today on Native America Calling. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with our other guests, and we're going to learn more about this issue here with regard to liver transplants and access with regard to Native American patients. And our phone lines are open right now. If you are listening right now and you have familiarity with this issue, maybe you've had a liver transplant or you need a liver transplant, or someone in your family or a friend is in that situation, you'd like to share your story, we'd sure love to hear it. 1-800-996-2848. That number again, 1-800-996-2848. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Deborah Jackson Taffa's memoir, Whiskey Tender, is both a personal story and a compelling course in Native American history. The Quechan and Laguna author writes from her own perspective as a child to question and analyze impacts of generational trauma and other issues that shape her identity. Taffa joins us on the next Native America Calling.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. You can kickstart your career by joining thousands of AmeriCorps members in the VISTA program serving to alleviate poverty. AmeriCorps members help organizations make change right in their own community. A service opportunity that fits your ambition can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
You're listening to Native America Calling. And today we're talking about liver transplants. The transplant process is arduous, and if you know someone who's gone through it, what did you learn about the steps involved in getting an organ transplant? Let us know. Our number's 1-800-996-2848. That number gets you right through to our studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We'll get your comments on the air. 1-800-996-2848. I want to introduce a fourth guest on our show today, Annie Gilbertson, who joins us from Berkeley, California. She is a journalist who wrote the article for the Washington Post that we referenced earlier and did the analysis on statistics on liver transplants in Native America. Annie, hello, and thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me, Sean, and thanks for the work that you do.
You bet. You bet. Well, please, with our listeners, if you could share some of the key points here of your article, specifically why the disparity there with regard to Native Americans and access to liver transplants.
We started looking at transplants across the country, and what got us to this subject is there was a recent change in how organs, how livers specifically, were going to be allocated across the country. Essentially, they used one way of sending out and figuring out which livers went to who, and they changed that way. And so we were looking at, okay, what did this change mean for certain communities across the country? And of course, we started asking questions about race. Because when you're looking for disparities in the United States, that's often a great place to start looking. And we realized there was a second story here where we saw that there was this group of people, Native Americans, who had a disproportionately high rate of liver disease death. We could see that in the Center for Disease Control mortality data. And yet these people were not getting on the transplant list, which is the only cure for end-stage liver disease, at the same rate as white people and Asian Americans and other groups. And so our reporting sought to figure out why. And I want to share a little bit with you about just like why this issue matters now. Transplants are supposed to be on the rise across the country in the next decade, and we're also seeing a huge, huge increase in liver disease. And so some of that uptick, they think, is heavy drinking during the pandemic. Of course, you can get liver disease from other things. Hepatitis C is one. Diet can also impact your liver. And really, we have this pressing need as a country to be looking at liver disease care and who is getting access to the care that they need and who isn't and who has been dying from what can be cured if it's caught. And so these were the questions that were swirling around in our head and what led to much of our reporting.
All right. So that's interesting then. So during the pandemic, I imagine people were home and they were stressed perhaps and they were drinking more. So what's the driving cause, though? Why ultimately did you discover in your research that Native Americans are not getting these liver transplants at rates of non-Native patients?
So we looked at many stages of transplant, right? So you have, on the front end, access to the wait list, and that's when you've been approved for transplant, and you're just waiting for an organ that's a match to become available. And we looked at people who were already on the wait list. How often were they getting transplants? And we also looked at people who were ultimately transplanted and their outcomes. And what we saw is that the disparities really existed on the front end. There is not much disparity. Once you get on the wait list for a liver, then you are likely to get that liver no matter your racial background. But the problem is, like I said, on the front end, and people are just not getting on the wait list, and instead they're dying from liver disease. And so you have to look upstream at sort of what does the healthcare system look like for intervening and making sure that these people get care, and where is it failing? And we talked to many, many experts, and, you know, it's a myriad of reasons, as you can imagine. It's living far from transplant centers. It's living far from specialists who you often see as a first step when your liver disease is identified. You're seeing a gastroenterologist, a hepatologist, and someone like that who can then make a referral out for a transplant. And so this is where experts said that a lot of the pipeline breaks down and where less economically advantaged people, which includes Native Americans in this country, unfortunately, are just falling off the pathway to transplant. And, you know, even just simple things like screening, right? Are we doing regular screening for liver disease, or is it like Dr. Christensen mentioned, people are finding out at the very, very last stage when there's very little that you can do and you're unlikely to be able to get on the transplant list because you're just too sick. So these are all factors in which become barriers to getting a transplant. And I just want to say that, you know, the transplant system, its founders, you know, it really became a national system in the early 80s. And its founders in our country, including groups of physicians and lawmakers, really wanted this system to be equal. If we were going to be having a donation system in our country, we did not want organs to be only going to the rich, only going to the powerful. You know, everybody is asked to become an organ donor, so it's essential that the process is fair and that there is not racial bias within the process. And, you know, one of our findings is just that we've still not been able to meet that mandate, that unfortunately there's big racial disparities in who's able to get an organ and who's able to get on that list and survive.
All right, Annie, thank you for coming on and giving us the Cliff's Notes version of that article in the Washington Post. And let's talk a little bit more about what it takes to get on that liver donor wait list. And as Annie mentions, some of it has to do with distance, and perhaps Native folks who live in more remote rural communities might have farther to drive to access a treatment center or a specialist, so that could certainly have something to do with it. But let's learn more from Dr. Erin Maynard, who's another one of our guests on the show, and she's the surgical director of the liver transplant program at the Portland VA. And Erin, thanks again for coming on the show. And please explain to our listeners, how does a person get their name on the liver donor wait list? Because according to the article, that's the issue here, is we're just not getting on those lists initially like some other patients are. So it sounds like that's the first step, is just getting people on that list.
Yeah, a lot of you know, what it takes to make it on the list has already been addressed in terms of what Dr. C and Annie Gilbertson said. It really starts with identification of disease, and that can be really difficult. In addition to kind of native liver disease from things like alcohol and hepatitis, as well as things that you can be born with, about 30 to 50% of patients who are transplanted across the United States are transplanted for liver cancer. We know that people that have liver disease are at a 20-fold increased risk of developing liver cancer. And there are screening guidelines that are out there and are published, but only 20% of patients that meet criteria for screening ever actually get screened for liver cancer. So that's just another place that we here in the United States are failing in terms of identifying patients who could potentially be cured of their cancer or their liver disease for transplant. Once the disease is identified, then they are referred to a transplant center. And then the transplant center has a number of tests that need to be performed, as well as a thorough evaluation. That evaluation can be very cumbersome. It takes a lot of time. There are social workers that meet with the patient and their social support. There's a medical evaluation. Liver transplant, while it can be life-saving, is a very stressful operation on the remainder of the body. It can be very stressful on the heart and on the kidneys. Some patients can wind up on dialysis post-liver transplant. Also, with transplant, you need to take medications to prevent your body from rejecting whatever organ is transplanted for the remainder of your life. That lowering of the immune system can place patients at an increased risk for developing cancer as well as infections. So you have to have thorough screening for cancers that have been done. So by the time you get your heart testing and cancer screening, there's also dental screening. This process can, while it can be done rapidly if someone is very sick, can also take upwards of a year. So there are kind of significant barriers to getting a lot of that testing done. And quite a bit of it has to do with travel. There really is good data out there to suggest that the farther away you live from a transplant center, the less likely you are to make it on the wait list. And part of that, I think, has to do with, although there's insurance and IHS to cover the cost of transplant, there are a lot of hidden costs to making it on the wait list when it comes to the amount of travel that's needed to get to a transplant center and get all of the testing that's required.
Erin, we heard Annie mentioned earlier that the program, the organ or liver transplant program, organ transplant program, about 40 years old, started back in the 1980s, and it's been designed to be equal and fair with regard to who gets transplants, who gets those organs. Do you think it's working? Do you think it's fair with regard to the process, or is there more work to be done?
I think whenever you have a more demand for any resource, in particular for organs, as opposed to the supply, there's always going to be inequities, unfortunately. When we look at how the national list works, it has been making progress over the last couple of decades. And while the transplant community looks at those inequities, nobody is capturing, and I think Annie speaks to this a little bit in her article, nobody is unfortunately able to capture who is not being referred. So I don't think we actually have a grasp on the true scope of the problem. I'm afraid it's actually much bigger than we think it is.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the donors and specifically the background or the race of a donor. Do, for a Native American person needing a liver transplant, do they have better options from a person who is a Native American donor, or does that make a difference?
It actually doesn't make a difference. Liver transplant is pretty simple when it comes to matching. We're typically just looking at the blood type as opposed to other organs that require additional tissue matching, and then the size of the donor and the recipient have to match.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the surgical process then. So let's say somebody's on the list and they find a match. Then what happens on your end as a surgeon? Walk us through that whole routine.
So when a liver becomes available, it essentially goes when a liver becomes available, it goes into a computer system, and the computer system ranks patients based on both location to a transplant, like the donor hospital, as well as their MELD. So MELD is a number that we get from your lab values that patients get from their blood work that they get every month. And when a liver becomes available, it should go to the person at the top of the list first, unless there's a reason that it wouldn't work for them. And one of those examples is size. So just like people come in different shapes and sizes, so do our livers. So not every liver from a donor will fit into the next recipient. And so essentially it just works down the list until you find a good home for it.
All right. And then you bring that person in and you perform that surgery. But how long does it take?
We tell patients and their families that they're usually back in the operating room for about 10 hours. From the time the patient goes back to the operating room, it's about 2 hours until we get started. There's a lot of additional IVs and tubes that are put in to help keep the patient safe while we're operating. The operation takes about 6 hours and then another hour to get them ready to go to the intensive care unit.
And how quickly will you know if it's a successful transplant or if there might be complications?
So we have signs actually in the operating room that we know that the new liver is working. And one of those things, the last connection that we make is putting the bile duct together. That's the tube that drains the liver of the fluid that it makes. And before we put that connection together, we should see that fluid draining from the liver.
All right. Dr. C, I want to bring you back into the conversation. And Annie uncovered in her research that during the pandemic, there was an increase in drinking. And I think, unfortunately, with a show like this, there are going to be those folks listening who might be skeptical and think, well, stereotypical issues with Native Americans and alcohol. Let's talk about that a little bit, Dr. C? Because as I understand it, alcoholism rates are actually going down in Indian country. Is that correct?
Yes, Sean, they are. And I think that is incredibly impactful to make an assumption, because the true percentage of American Indian Alaskan Natives that intensively use alcohol is actually much smaller than everybody thinks. It's just unfortunate that those do tend to get very sick and may actually die of that liver disease. So that's always been a misnomer to me. But I think that is a great point that was made in the article, in that we know substance use disorders went way up. And that includes, the co-use of alcohol along with other substances. And unfortunately, overdoses went up, and of course, suicides went up. It was an extremely stressful time in Indian country during the pandemic, isolation, lack of community, which is so very important to our people, that I think the stress was just tremendous. So I do think it did go up pretty substantially during that time. And overall, we do see some declines in the use of alcohol, which is good news, but there's still further to go with that. We still have people that we need to help and support. Hopefully some of this was episodic and it won't be an ongoing chronic use of alcohol, but this is why we're trying to intervene very quickly with substance use and alcohol management, and also with behavioral health and mental health support, because sometimes people are basically self-medicating. They feel stressed, they feel terrible, they'll drink or use a substance. So we have to take care of the whole patient. So it's a whole spectrum that has to be looked at.
We're going to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with our next guest, Selena Thomas, who is a patient navigator for the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix. Give us a call if you'd like to join this conversation, if you have insights to add with regard to liver transplants, 1-800-996-2848. We'll be right back.
I'm Michael, and I used to smoke. I never used to think about breathing. Then my left lung collapsed and I was diagnosed with COPD. Now I think about breathing all the time. I'm on an oxygen machine so I can breathe. I take medicine so I can breathe. My tip is enjoy the breaths you don't have to think about. You don't know how long you'll have them.
Smoking can cause COPD. You can quit. For free help, visit cdc.gov/quitnow. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and we're talking about access to liver transplants. Alcohol-caused liver failure, or cirrhosis, is a contentious topic in this field because a common conception is people who destroyed their liver with alcohol won't get on the donors list. That's not always the case. If you have questions about the liver transplant process, give us a call. And as always, we encourage people with specific medical questions to first consult their physicians. Our number to the studio, 1-800-996-2848. And before we begin with our next guest, Selena Thomas, Dr. C, I want to go back to you here just with regard to that issue with alcohol abuse. And let's say, for example, if you have somebody, a Native American patient, and you go through the screening and you do find that they suffer from chronic alcoholism, will that or will that not impact their likelihood of getting on that donor list?
Well, I want to say overall, no. If we are able to intervene earlier in the disease and say, okay, let's get you support to stop any use of alcohol or other substances. The transplant criteria does require that 6 months or so of having sobriety or no use of substances, because you want the liver to succeed. You want the transplant to succeed. If there's things that would deter that from happening, then you should wait a period of time to make sure that person is ready to give up the alcohol, ready to give up any drugs they may be using, because the success of that transplant goes up quite a bit. All the things have to be positive, and for the liver to succeed, you don't want to ingest anything into the body that might damage that or stop that liver from functioning fully. So there is a period of time to be able to stay off of that, and we should be helping to do that, so if they still need to be on the transplant list, that we can get them on the list. So it's a whole process, and I think it's a fair one, because you want the donation and the transplant to be successful.
All right.
There's so few organs out there.
Right, right. Well, what do you think is the solution then to getting more people on the transplant list? I mean, it sounds like geography has a lot to do with it, but is it as simple as just having more facilities closer to Native communities, or perhaps having more Native people living in urban areas?
Well, you know, it was a great point that was brought up. It is the, I call rural and extreme rural areas. And what we're doing at the IHS is we're creating better ways to help transportation, because that is a huge issue. Can you get them to the doctor with some family support? How can we support that back and forth between where we are and where the transplant center might be? Sometimes we have to support them staying closer to the center. And we're adapting what we do to try to be more positive in that support. And then that would encourage people to actually follow through with their appointments and commit to what's necessary to be successful in a transplant. So that is definitely part of it. Again, the second thing I mentioned before is awareness. How do you know you have damaged liver? How do you know that you need intervention? We need to get on that right away as well.
All right. Thank you, Dr. C. Selena Thomas, our next guest in Phoenix, Arizona, patient navigator for the Mayo Clinic. And Selena, hello again, and welcome to the show. Yate. And you work with Native people who are in the process of getting organ transplants. So let's hear your perspective, including those who are working with liver transplants. What's the biggest hurdle that patients you work with, what's the biggest hurdle they face?
Hello, everyone, and thank you for allowing me to be here. One of the biggest hurdles that I have encountered with Native patients is transportation and lodging. So one of the requirements after transplant is for the patient to stay here locally within an hour from Mayo Clinic, because they need continued follow-up with blood tests and imaging and frequent visits, you know, to the doctor, lab tests, you know, things like that. And they have to stay around here for at least 6 weeks for kidneys and a little bit longer for liver transplants. So I believe, you know, one of the biggest hurdles is transportation and lodging.
And do you feel you have adequate resources to assist with that lodging and transportation that's so desperately needed?
No, I don't. I know that some health plans here in Arizona, for example, Medicaid, which is the Arizona Access, which is the Arizona Medicaid program, some plans do provide the benefit of transportation and lodging. But if a person is being referred directly from Indian Health Services under the purchase referred care, they do not provide, as far as I know, they do not provide any assistance with lodging or transportation. So that's where a lot of the problems lie with most patients that I meet.
All right. Well, let's put a human face on this, Selena. And I mean, have you worked recently with somebody who desperately needs a liver transplant? They're on the list. There's a match. Everything will work for them. They just don't have enough money to pay for lodging or travel to the hospital. Do you have stories like that? Examples?
I have many examples like that. Not necessarily for liver. I'm sure there are, you know, examples like that, but even for kidney transplants. I have a patient that recently lost his access, his Medicaid plan for Arizona, and he reapplied. He qualified again, but it was under a different plan, and that plan does not cover transportation or lodging. So he desperately wants to come back, you know, to continue the evaluation, but he can't because he does not have a place to stay and he does not have transportation. So there are many patients that have that same issue, and it's just, you know, hard for them to try to come here. Then these patients are traveling from 4 or 5 hours away sometimes, and these evaluations, these appointments sometimes can last a week.
Okay, yeah, I can imagine how quickly those costs would rise then if people need extended lodging like that. Selena, let's also talk about some of the cultural elements here. And of course, as we know, Native American people, sometimes they might be hesitant or they might feel you know, the idea of having an organ like a liver transplanted from another person into their bodies, they might take issue with that, or they might think that certain precautions or maybe ceremonies need to take place. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So when I first make the first phone call to these patients, I usually start from the beginning. I ask them basic questions, asking them if they've been referred. I mean, if they know about the referral, if they know what a transplant is. I also assess for barriers such as language and literacy, health literacy. So these are the things that I talk to them about when I first talk to them. I also ask them about about cultural beliefs. I ask them if there are any cultural beliefs or anything like that that we need to consider or we need to accommodate when and if the transplant happens. I do have patients that have asked me about transplants. Some of them are still hesitant. Some of them are still thinking about whether or not they should continue with the evaluation. They ask me questions like, has anyone that's been transplanted come back to you and provided feedback about how the deceased organ, the person, the deceased person has come to bother them or has come back, those are the kinds of questions that I get. And I always encourage these patients. I tell them, this is, things that you're struggling with. I would recommend, whatever cultural beliefs you have, I would recommend that you, seek advice from your healer, from your medicine man, maybe have a prayer done before you come here and start the process. These are things that I discuss with them. And here at Mayo Clinic, we are also working on implementing a policy and allowing patients to either smudge or burn cedar or do any of those cultural prayers that they would like to do while they're here in the hospital.
Selena, this is all really inspiring to hear about your work and how you support. It sounds like you do you wear a lot of different hats. You hold hands and you offer that emotional support, but you also provide education, you provide awareness, you provide advocacy. What do you think the solution is? In addition, perhaps, to just the geography we're talking about and just more funding to provide lodging and transportation, can you think of other ways that this system could be improved so that more Native American people get the liver transplants that they need?
I think it could start. I know someone had mentioned catching the disease early, and I think health literacy and health education is very important early on. I know that when I meet with patients, the lack of understanding their disease and the lack of understanding how difficult and how long this journey can be for these patients, they don't understand these. And so I think, producing health education and languages that they can understand is very important. I was recently at a tribal summit, and this is something that I brought up, just even talking about chronic diseases, diabetes and liver disease, heart disease. These are basic things. These are chronic diseases that a lot of patients, they know they have, but they don't understand. So I think producing this education and language in their own languages that they can understand might help with compliance and understanding.
Selena, other specialty centers, do they all have patient navigators such as yourself who's there, available, able, and ready to assist patients?
Not that I know of here in the Phoenix area, but I know that I'm a patient navigator here in the transplant center. We have a patient navigator that serves American Indian Alaska Native patients in the cancer center here at Mayo Clinic. But my goal, and hopefully with more exposure about my role, hopefully we'll expand this role to other healthcare facilities here in Arizona, because, in Arizona, we do have 22 federally recognized tribes. And I believe having a role like this, to serve Native patients and other races would be very beneficial.
And what got you into this kind of work, Selena?
So I was a medical assistant for about 10 years. And about 2 years ago, I was presented this opportunity. There was a liver patient that was referred here for evaluation, and there was a language barrier. He was Navajo speaking, and that got some of the transplant team to think about this barrier and how they weren't looking at how to help this. And so they started talking about this role, and it was a pilot program at first, but it was recently June of 2023 when it became a full-time position. So I am very happy to be in this role. It is very rewarding for me, and I look forward to making an impact here.
And Selena, do you ever have patients who successfully have liver transplants, and they come back to you and they say, "Hey, Selena, thank you, because if it hadn't been for you, if it hadn't been for your assistance, I never would have gotten that transplant. I never would have gone through it, or somebody in my family never would have gone through it." Do you hear that?
Yes. Yes, I hear that, and that's the most wonderful thing to hear when a patient does come back to me and say that. Even during the evaluation, you know, patients come here and they're overwhelmed by the size of our building and the staff, and there's just so much going on. So during, you know, even before they come here, I tell them about these things, about what to expect, and I try to meet with them before they, you know, when they walk in the door, and take them to their appointments, and, you know, make them feel a little better. And sometimes just seeing another Native face, you know, makes you feel better. And especially if they speak the same language as you, that's, you know, even better for the patient. You know, it makes them feel comfortable right away. So I love what I do, and I hope that healthcare facilities, you know, across the nation can implement more rules like mine.
All right. Thank you, Selena. Aaron, I want to go back to you. We've got a couple of minutes here before we have to wrap up the show. And let's think about people who are listening to the show right now. Maybe there's somebody right now who maybe has some issues there with their liver, or maybe they have some symptoms. What can you do? What advice can you offer that person right now who might be in the early stages of needing a liver transplant?
Like, understanding that we are here and we want to help. And so, like, seeking help, speaking with their family and loved ones that they're concerned that they have a problem, and going to see their primary care physician so they can kind of start along that pathway. I think, you know, in the end, everybody on this phone call, you know, our whole goal is to try to get patients the help that they need.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. And Dr. C, back to you. I'm going to give you the last word. We've got about a minute. What's your advice for our listeners right now?
Well, I think it is just to be aware, to seek help when you need it, and know that you will be supported across our agency, because we were there to support the people that we serve. So take care of yourself, keep yourself healthy. But when you need help, please come and see us.
All right. And with that, we are going to wrap up our show now. Big thank you to our guest today, Dr. Aaron Maynard, Dr. Loretta Christensen, Selena Thomas, and Annie Gilbertson, for walking us through the process and explaining some of the issues, some of the challenges, and other related factors with regard to liver transplants and Native American populations. I do hope you'll join us again tomorrow for a conversation with Quechan and Laguna Pueblo author Deborah Jackson Taffa about her new memoir, Whiskey Tender. I'm Sean Spruce, and I hope you'll tune in.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
How mitakuya piki.
February chante we are pihecha. Chante wanki lakayo, otchana piicha, wayatina, was agicha unwo, wayat in the ayushtayo, chante wayaza, huch, you hapcha, gunki o wogalag unpo. Isama sola chihanta, lakol waoki otl yayo, nishhealthcare.gov, nishlilmas apkayo, 1-800-318-2596. Le wotchaniki, Medicare and Medicaid otieta hiyapala.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.